have today two hearings on two rules. Justice Bradley is participating and asked us to begin, and she will join us. For that which she has missed, she will listen to the tape. The first is 10:09 in the matter of the amended petition to amend various rules in Chapter 20 of the Supreme Court Rules, presented by Attorney John Nicholas Schweitzer. Schweitzer, your turn.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. Thank you for allowing me to appear. If I may, I'll give you a one-minute summary of why I think I'm qualified to propose any changes to Supreme Court rules, and then I'll talk about the petition itself. For over 20 years, my practice was, and it still is, professional discipline, both as a referee in attorney disciplinary hearings for this court and as an administrative law judge handling disciplinary hearings involving other licensed professionals for what's now the Department of Safety and Professional Services. Since 2008, as an adjunct professor at the UW Law School, I've taught a section of the mandatory professional responsibility class, and in that class we cover every one of the rules in Chapter SCR 20. So I think I can say I know the rules better than the average attorney in Wisconsin. Some of the attorneys who know the rules better than I do may be here in this chamber. Each time I teach the rules, the students and I note something that is less than perfect, something that could be improved. Even the textbooks that I've used point out weaknesses and inconsistencies in some of the rules. I made a list of those imperfections, which became my original petition. That's my background, and that's why I feel qualified to stand here to propose changes. Moving on to the petition itself, admittedly, what you have before you is not what I submitted in October of 2010. That petition proposed 17 changes. I admit now that submitting a list of 17 changes over a wide area was probably overwhelming. The amended petition proposes only two changes, and with your permission, I'll briefly explain the transformation from 17 to 2. After you received my petition, you requested that I send the petition to the OLR, the Family Law Section, the Professional Ethics Committee, and the law school faculty at UW and Marquette. I did that. I notified you after 60 days that I had received no responses, and then you would discuss the petition in an administrative conference early in 2011 and ask me to convene a working group consisting of members of the OLR, BAO, Family Law Section, Professional Ethics Committee, and Tim Pierce. I made those requests, and I received responses from Tim Pierce, Dean Dietrich representing the Professional Ethics Committee, the OLR designating Elizabeth Estes as its representative, and the BAO designating Mark Peterson as its representative. I received no response from the Family Law Section, even though I sent a follow-up letter. A conference call with those participants was held in July 2011. Mr. Peterson explained that he was to head a subcommittee of the BAO, which would meet and prepare written comments on the petition a couple of months later, but he said he didn't intend to participate in the working group after that, although the BAO would like to review any revised petition. Dean Dietrich prepared written comments. The BAO sent its comments, including objections to many of the proposed changes. Another conference call was held in October, and we had an in-person working session in November, following which the list of 17 was reduced to 7. Including a couple of new proposals made by Tim Pierce, being items that he said would make his work as ethics counsel easier, either because they would resolve an inconsistency in the rules or put useful information in a place where attorneys could see it more readily. A draft of an amended petition was prepared and circulated. Another conference call was held in January of 2012, following which it was forwarded to the BAO. A response from the BAO was received in February of 2013. Which included a number of comments, including objections to all but two of the proposed amendments. In order largely to bring this process to a close without abandoning it completely, the amended petition was prepared and filed in April of this year with just two proposed changes, the ones that are here before you today, the two which no one objected. For the record, Tim Pierce and Dean Dietrich agreed with the filing, whereas OLR's response was that it didn't object, though it didn't see the need for the proposed changes. I will now explain what is before you in just a couple of sentences. The amendment to SCR 20:4.1 arises from the fact that the existing rules prohibit an attorney from engaging in any conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. But everyone seems to acknowledge that there is a legitimate purpose in some supervision of misrepresentation, such as lawyers associated with law enforcement advising sting operations, civil attorneys developing a discrimination case by sending people to pose as potential renters, etc. All of the texts and commentaries on Rule 4.1 say these sorts of investigated rules, ruses, do take place, but they aren't really allowed under the rule. And there are some jurisdictions where attorneys have been disciplined for supervising investigators who essentially lie to develop information.
Well, what are we talking about? Are we talking about we had a case, well, there was a case that lawyers agreed to send people around to make comments or to find out whether people would rent to young people, old people,
yes,
black people, white people. And the question was that a violation of the code? Are you familiar with that?
I am not familiar with a particular case that you may be referring to. I know that that is exactly the type of activity that is talked about.
That was, I think, civil.
That would be civil.
Civil issue.
There was a more famous case in Oregon. It was Henry Gatti, in which a person investigated a chiropractor who was making inflated claims, et cetera. But it was the same sort of investigation, and the attorney who hired the investigators was actually disciplined for developing the information. So that's...
Under what? That a lawyer may advise or supervise with respect to lawful investigative,
yes,
activities?
That
and
is in
that,
the...
You can advise, but you can't tell them they can make false statement. You
didn't
can advise quite. Them, but that you have to tell them that they can't do an investigation making false statements. Is that the point?
Well, that would be the reading of the rules as they're currently written. There is a Wisconsin committee comment, which is what I'm proposing moving up into the rule, which does seem to address this. A little change to that might be an improvement. It moves the text of that language, which I think is meant to address exactly this situation in the committee comment. You have the text there. A lawyer may supervise, act as an advisor or supervisor, only when the lawyer in good faith believes that there is unlawful activity taking place.
I know, but what has that got to do? That's notwithstanding paragraph A, so notwithstanding the fact that in course of representing a client, they can't make false statements. Is that the point?
It is not the same. In fact, if I were to submit this to you or start again, I would add two words to that committee comment, which is supervise activity involving deception. I mean, I think that's what the committee comment intended and what I actually would intend. As you move that comment up, may supervise or advise or supervise lawful investigative activity involving deception.
You know, that's the point. That's why it's a confusing sentence, in my opinion.
It's the committee comment could have gone.
I mean, that's what I was driving at. You know, when it's a comment and it's we don't adopt it and it's a series of comments that are not necessarily tied together with the transitions and segues, it's one thing.
Right.
But when it's put into the code, it becomes troublesome and you got to tie it together. So that's what I thought you were driving at. Okay.
And indeed, I suggested only moving that comment up because I tried to make as few changes as possible as I was doing this.
Right. That's smart.
Involving deception would be a useful phrase to add to that. Okay, so that is the proposed change to 4.1, and the amendment to SCR 20:8.4 would add language to the Wisconsin comment, that would make attorneys more aware of their obligation to report convictions to the OLR. The obligation exists now, but it's in SCR 21, I think 15. It is not mentioned in SDR 20. And it just, Tim Pierce is the one who suggested this because he said it would make his job easier to point out you have to report your convictions and it's there in the professional responsibility code, not in a different chapter. So those are the proposals. I'd like to make just one more observation about the piece of paper that I had handed out to you. It's about our state. Specifically, how it has been often a leader in the area of rules of professional conduct. I get a great feeling of pride in my class by being able to say at least a dozen times over a semester that Wisconsin was in some way a leader or a groundbreaker with regard to some rule. The changes in that handout will show a dozen of them, and I rest feeling assured that you share some of my interest in making sure that the rules for attorneys are the best possible. That's my presentation. I'll take any questions or comments.
I have another question.
Yes.
You have an effective date. Your second proposal adds a comment. In addition to the obligations in this rule, Wisconsin attorneys should note the obligation in 21.15.5. To notify the Office of Lawyer Regulation and the Supreme Court. Who do they send it to? The clerk's office? Should notify
someone
the office.
Else in this room could probably tell
I mean,
you
I don't want the notice. I mean, I don't want to come into my office and then I have to figure out who gets that. So if we were to adopt, you say notify the Office of Lawyer Regulation and I'm going to put clerk of the Supreme Court. Is that who you mean? I'm looking at your comment that you want added.
There's probably no need to notify the Supreme Court.
I didn't think so. Oh, the OLR is enough.
Yes.
Take out the Supreme Court in the comment.
I'm comfortable with that.
Okay.
That was.
But if it's in, I would suggest you give an office. If convicted of a crime and the obligation in SCR 22221 to notify the director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation of public discipline for misconduct or license suspension, etc. And I'm assuming you want to put this in so it's absolutely clear and that lawyers remember that, right?
Yes.
It's a comment. And I guess I don't have to worry about the effective date because it says here the proposed effective date is the change would be effective January 1, 2013. That's gone. But it, even if you said 2014 or picked any date, my question would be, would not apply, I assume, to any conduct preceding the effective date?
Well, I disagree with that only
That's
because
why I'm asking the question.
Yes. The conduct is already brought within the rules in those other chapters. It's simply this, as well as my original proposal, many of them were simply to make things clearer to attorneys to notify them of their obligations. So they already had the obligation.
So it's effective for conduct before.
The effective date seems immaterial to me. And if I may just comment, since I see that I have put in this, the first notification is to the Office of Lawyer Regulation and the Supreme Court, and the second is to the Director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. I'm guessing that I'm taking that language out of those other two rules.
Yeah,
I would
I'll
have
look,
to look at
I'll
again.
Look at them, but this is a comment, and if we can improve,
yes,
it would be a
indeed.
Good idea, right? So I will check that. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments? Well, I want to,
Professor?
If I might, I just want to say that you have worked long and hard on lawyer ethics, served as a referee and appeared by letter or otherwise on a number of issues, and from my perspective, been a very good citizen whether or not at any particular point the court agrees with your suggestions, it's very appreciative of your efforts in your continuing concern and interest.
Thank you.
Justice Prosser.
What does the term unlawful activity mean in your proposed amendment to 20.24.1?
I won't put myself in a position of saying that I knew what was behind the drafter's intention in writing that. I mean, I would be glad to try to do some thinking and some research on that. The law enforcement agencies, as well as the attorneys who investigate such things as discrimination complaints, would be the ones to define. We are trying to develop information about drug sales or about discrimination in renting properties, et cetera. I won't claim that I have an excellent definition of, quote, unlawful activity. Your question about the language is good.
Well, it's...
That is what's there now in the Wisconsin committee comment.
You just moved it up.
Yeah.
This seems to, as I read it, and I'm not a close student of these rules as you are, this strikes me as limiting an attorney's involvement as an advisor or supervisor to situations in which there is a violation of statutory law of some sort. In other words, let's say I was a family law attorney.
I understand, if I may. I think I understand your point. Reading this literally, you could say this is a limiting clause rather than expanding one.
Oh, yes.
Because it says you may only supervise this in this situation. I like that comment. I think it actually may be related to my response to Justice Abraham some earlier, which is I think that would be improved by saying lawful investigative activity involving deception may involve a lawyer only when. Does that make sense?
The whole thing is premised with the first clause, notwithstanding A, which deals with misinformation.
Among my many vices, I occasionally watch old Perry Mason shows, which means I'm not getting as much sleep as I should on television. And you remember Perry and his relationship with Paul Drake.
Some degree, yes.
Okay. Every once in a while, Paul Drake does some things that are, I wouldn't say they're illegal, but they strike me as they're not totally forthright.
Well, they involve some deception.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you remember the format of the show is that usually Perry's clients look to be the guilty ones. So he always comes up with some other offender, but...
I think you are addressing exactly what this rule talks about and the issue that has come up, which is the rules themselves, as you read them, especially 4.1, a lawyer should not, and Perry Mason should not have engaged in that. This is providing him with the right to do it if he honestly believes that there is some unlawful activity taking place. That's the phrasing. And I think your suggestion goes along with my suggested improvement, which I'd like to make for you to consider in your discussion, to add that phrase, lawful investigative activity involving deception may occur only in a certain situation.
That's exactly what's missing.
Well taken.
You're amending that?
Please.
Would this apply to people dealing in international affairs?
I don't understand the question.
Well, we have attorneys placed all over the place. Do you think that deception is ever involved in international relations?
I took one class in international law, and that was many years ago. And I would be totally speculating to follow your line of thought. It's a very interesting question. Lawyers are bound by their rules in their state. If a Wisconsin lawyer were involved in negotiations with the Chinese for something, the Wisconsin lawyer should follow our rules.
If he's a lawyer, if he's acting as a lawyer.
Correct.
You know, let me just put my cards on the table here. When sentences of this nature are written into the law, and you have terms like unlawful activity that are very imprecise, it invites very selective enforcement. That's troublesome to me.
I understand your concern with words, and in fact, if I may back off for a second, in addition to my work as an administrative law judge with that department, I was board counsel to a number of boards, for example, the medical board. And we would spend hours. I took great pride in crafting administrative rules that meant what they said and said what they meant. And I know the difference of a change of a word. So I absolutely appreciate. I will explain this only as I did before. I tried to make as few changes as I could in this proposal, so I simply took the sentence that was in the Wisconsin committee comment already with unlawful activity and said, let's move it up where people will see it. I would not mind trying to improve that language along the lines of what you said so that it really fits the circumstances in which lawyers are not only allowed but encouraged to engage in deception. Once again, I think your comment is right on. I hope I've explained why I did it my way.
Well, the words unlawful activity didn't bother me because I think they're words that are defined in the dictionary, and unlawful means against the law, civil, criminal. Law could mean case, statute, regulation.
Also a rather vague term that could
lead. It means you can get clipped under it, whether it's a fine or a forfeiture or going to prison.
Yes.
So you're going to have a hard time making that any more precise, unless you do rule, statute, et cetera. And then it's federal, state, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, do you raise more problems than necessary? And the other question is, if I remember this, there was a long discussion because the prosecutors were very worried about that sentence, right?
When the Wisconsin committee comment was made?
Right.
Okay, I wasn't privy to that, but I would expect to be so.
Yes.
And the public defenders.
Yeah, the public defenders too. Although, at least the case I remember had nothing to do with either criminal law, and it was testing out
discrimination.
And so that it just has become very, but you didn't hear anything from the prosecutors on yours.
And I didn't specifically approach them. They're in my original petition, there actually was a proposal to address prosecutors.
Right.
In their rule, and that is not before you today.
Okay.
But it would be similar to this.
Thank you for your responses. Are there any other questions, comments?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any
Oh, if I may say, I don't mean to be rude, but I will be leaving. I'm going to be teaching the very rule that we're talking about, 8.4, in about an hour.
I know, and you were very kind to advise us about that, and you are excused. There are no appearances noted. Does anyone wish to appear in favor or in opposition to 1009 in the matter of the amended petition to amend various rules in Chapter 20? Did we get any comments? I think not in writing. If there are no appearances, the hearing on 1009 in the matter of the amended petition to amend various rules in Chapter 20 is closed. I will now call 1303 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rules 10033 and 7 relating to inactive members requesting active status and readmissions after resignation. Mr. Saleen, Director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, will present this petition. Mr. Levine.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. It's a pleasure to be here this morning to present 1303. The petition makes two proposals to you. One is to amend Rule 1003 sub 3B regarding to the return to active status for a member who has been inactive, and it makes a particular recommendation with regard to those who have not been active in Wisconsin for over 10 years. It deletes a provision that would allow them to be summarily reactivated through the state bar if they were actively practicing in another jurisdiction. The change would require that the lawyer go through review by the Supreme Court and recommendations from BBE and OLR in a circumstance where they were inactive in Wisconsin for more than 10 years, regardless of practice in another jurisdiction. The second proposal is to create a procedure in 1003 sub 7 that would provide a procedure for a lawyer who has resigned the license to be readmitted in Wisconsin after the resignation. And that proposal would require the court's approval and a review and recommendations from BBE and OLR in every circumstance, regardless of the timing, simply because there is a concern for a potential jurisdictional gap for anything that might have occurred during that time period. These petitions were filed and are recommended by the Board of Administrative Oversight, State Bar of Wisconsin, the Board of Bar Examiners, and my office. In your materials, you should have responses to the questions that were addressed to all the petitioners from Commissioner Rich, and in addition to that, the comments made that OLR had in response to the suggestions of the Legislative Reference Bureau. And so with that, I think the court has the record. I would be happy to answer questions that you have.
Okay. You know, we have another petition that deals with classifications of members in the state bar. And that's emeritus and 70 to 75 and et cetera. Does this petition have anything to do with that?
Chief Justice, this petition is not designed or intended to address that concern.
Okay.
Well, should it?
I think, Justice Bradley, there may be some more work to do on that issue, and so it might be appropriate for the court to resolve this petition and certainly should deal with that other issue. I would be glad to assist the court in that endeavor if it desires, but I think the issues are distinct. It may require another modification to the rule, certainly, but I don't think that that issue would affect the provisions in the petition you have before you.
because you're dealing with, regardless of the class, you're dealing with the member of a bar regardless of the classification.
The part of it deals, Chief Justice, with the reactivation of a member. And so the change for the other issue where someone becomes emeritus, and before they might be inactive, but becoming emeritus, then they have that authority to practice again. So there is an issue that must be dealt with, but I think that can be dealt with in the language of the rule that relates to emeritus status, or perhaps by creation of another status within the bar, an issue that has not been resolved. But regardless of how the person would be reactivated, it could be addressed for an emeritus member in that other provision, and it probably would not involve a member who is inactive more than 10 years. If it does involve a member who is inactive more than 10 years, I think that should be also dealt with in that emeritus classification.
You answered the issue of what actively practiced law means. And what is and you say it's the practice of law similar to the requirement in 4005-1B. Is that foreign license coming in on another state's license?
Yes, Chief Justice, I believe that is correct.
Because from my perspective, that causes a lot of problems. And I found the response, maybe I'm not reading right, not totally consistent. It seems to me you could say if you've got an active license, that is a license that shows you eligible to practice law, that's good enough. So that would make an inactive license, and if they had something like that and was in Illinois, or even here, and it was inactive. But I don't see. I don't know if we know what actively practiced law means. 4005-1B. Proof that the applicant has been substantially engaged in the practice of law. This is legal competence on admission to the bar from a foreign, for another state, right?
That's how I understand it, Chief
right.
Justice,
okay.
Yes.
So why don't we use the same language, substantially engaged in the practice of law?
I think that would be a good phrase to use.
So that we know, so use, and you can even have a cross-reference, so that's what you're doing in 4005, you carry it over. I mean, I don't know if that's the answer, or that you should just do something simple of license to practice. But I think that we should use the same sentence, if that same phrase, if that's what's intended. You see, in context of 3B, the term should mean that the license was active status, good standing, and substantially engaged in the practice of law. So let's use that.
I agree, Chief Justice. That would be a good thing for us to do.
All right. And that covers, I guess, your showing under in Polk. I did not read Polk to see if that was a foreign license issue.
I may have that with me. I do not recall it as a foreign license issue. I recalled it as an administrative suspension and a petition for reinstatement, but I can check that for you if I have a moment.
Okay.
May I?
Yeah, go ahead.
As I understand, part of this petition is that you're submitting that the better practice is to require a fitness investigation and court review whenever a member has been inactive in Wisconsin for over 10 years and requests active status. Is that right? Where in the rule that you're proposing does this fitness language appear?
Would you like me to refer to the LRB version or to the petition?
That's a great question, and the one that I was working with is the black line version of draft proposal, but I don't know if you have that. Maybe we could do a clean version of the draft proposal. Do you have that?
I do not. What I have is a copy of the LRB version, and I have a copy of what I filed with the petition.
Let me get on the same page. Do you want to come on up here? No, I'm just teasing. No,
what about if you do the black line, you probably have a black line version.
I have a black line that was provided by the Legislative Reference Bureau.
Yes, that's and those comments are incorporated. Right. Let's try that one. Okay, so where does it indicate that
Justice
there
Bradley.
Has to be a fitness investigation, and that would be, you know, moral, right? I mean, the fitness
yes.
is, you know, okay.
Justice Bradley, I believe that would be in 1003 sub 3 B. One or B1B, I think is, and the numbering in my LRB version may not be correct because you'll see that it has B1 at the top,
yes,
and then it has 2A,
yes,
and then it has 1B. I think it should be 2B in
okay.
that draft, so I think that's a typo. But in 2B,
2B for me is on the top line of page 2. I don't know, is that...
I have a different document,
okay.
I'm sorry.
Okay, but let's stay with 2B then, I guess.
Just read the language that you're relying on, Mr. Stewart.
Yeah, the language would say, an inactive member seeking to change his or her classification to active member shall file a copy of his or her request for transfer to active membership with each of the Board of Bar Examiners and the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Next sentence, the member shall pay, and then after that it says, within 90 days... et cetera. The Board of Bar Examiners shall make a determination. Next sentence, within 90 days, the Director of the Office of Lawyer Regulations shall investigate the eligibility. And then following
okay, that's my, see, this is exactly my point. There's nowhere in here that talks about the fitness investigation.
Right.
Do you mean, so where, what do you, is eligibility the fitness investigation? What's eligibility?
That's what I believe that language means, Justice Bradley, and it certainly would agree with making it more clear if the court desired to do that.
And, you know, in our world, oftentimes, since this is being viewed in part like ab initio, you know, like from the beginning, you know, they've been out for a while, they haven't had this stuff, so we're going to have the in the fitness and the moral standing tests. Oftentimes, in that context, when it is from the beginning, it is BBE that is doing that. But here, apparently, OLR is going to do that character and fitness assessment. Am I correct?
That is correct, Justice
okay.
Bradley.
I in reading this, didn't know who was going to do it. And
okay.
Perhaps if that's what this is all about, investigate the eligibility, because I didn't know what that language meant, but I knew this whole thing, or at least the part that I'm talking about, the essence of it is to require a character and fitness investigation. And I didn't know if eligibility meant something else. I didn't know what it meant.
I thought
you know,
the court's, I thought Commissioner Rich's question, which I know came from the court, was very appropriate, and I was hopeful that the information in my memo would help clarify that. I would be happy to either work on language or suggest language to put into the rule in response to that concern. But I agree with you, it can be made more clear.
There's a typo in there.
Inactive, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
And inactive members. We just have a typo.
And does that deal with an inactive member who has or has not actively practiced during the last 10 years? 2B.
Chief Justice, I believe 2B refers to the member who has not practiced actively in Wisconsin during the last 10 years. and that language should be reflected for you in 2A to make that distinction.
Who has? So you think 2A affects someone who hasn't practiced?
That's correct.
And 2B?
It outlines the process for that person in 2A.
Okay, well, we have to make that clear. Where's the process for someone who has actively practiced?
Chief Justice, that would be in 3B1.
Okay. And there's a problem, I think, of who does not who does, but making clear that this is a character
and fitness assessment, and it's done
right.
By the OLR.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the other reference for the one who hasn't?
A lawyer who has not been active in the state
for more than
10 years, that would be covered by 2A and 2B.
And one who has been active? I've been active for 9 years, and on the 10th year, I pull out. And the 11th year, I want to come back in.
The time period is measured from when the inactive status begins to when the petition is filed to request transfer to active.
So what do I do if I've only been inactive for a year?
If you've been inactive for 1 year, then 10.03 sub 3B1 applies, and then that lawyer...
just by filing a request
filing
and paying
with the state
the
bar,
dues.
And the state bar would then process that request.
All right, so every 9 years, that's what I should do if that's what I want, so I can avoid the rest of this stuff.
There would be a transfer to active status that would normally result when the request is within 10 years. Mm-hmm. So there would not be a need to do this repeatedly unless the member decided to inactivate again. But yes,
yeah.
I could activate, inactivate, and then come back again later, sure. Mm-hmm.
What do I get for that other than the fuss of being investigated? Do I get cheaper dues as a result of
there
that
would be
kind
a,
of...
If it's over 10 years, then of course there are payments to the Board of Bar Examiners and the OLR for conducting their investigative work and filing their report. And there's a delay in the time period because the State Bar can process these quite promptly. Typically, we respond to the petition to the court within 90 days or shortly thereafter when more time is required.
Just for my clarification, if someone is inactive in Wisconsin for more than 10 years, but active in another jurisdiction during that time, mm-hmm. do they have to receive court approval?
Yes, Justice, they would.
And if they have been inactive in Wisconsin for 10 years, but active during that time someplace else, do they have to have character and fitness?
Yes, Justice, yeah.
Why?
The concern is that we want to be sure after that long of a time period that a lawyer has met the competence requirements, CLE essentially, and that we are aware of any character and fitness concerns because it's been a long time. We would want to contact the other jurisdiction where the lawyer may be licensed and active to make sure that we understand if there is any discipline that was either not reported or was perhaps private, or whether there was any other conduct that could affect the lawyer's fitness, just as a means to protect the citizens of Wisconsin. 10 years is a long time.
Yes, certainly if there was total inactivity for 10 years, mm-hmm. The need is obvious. To me, it's a little less obvious if someone had an inactive status in Wisconsin, but was practicing for 10 years in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a little less
As a matter
obvious.
Of degree, you're certainly correct.
When you have this attorney from Minnesota asking for reciprocity in Wisconsin, then is a character and fitness assessment done in the request for reciprocity?
I do not know.
It would seem to me that, seems to me this, why would, if it's not required, I would guess that the attorney from Minnesota would say, the heck with his character and fitness stuff, I'll just apply for reciprocity. Oh, why should I fool around with that?
It's a good question, Justice Bradley, and I believe that the BBE director would know the answer to that question immediately, but mm-hmm. I'm sorry that I do not.
Is it, your office is the consummate character and fitness office in some way in this state because you deal with lawyer discipline. But just in your response, it highlights that oftentimes BBE, again, as I earlier indicated, is the entity that does the character and fitness. Why are you doing character and fitness in this rather than BBE, which is part of their regular course of responsibilities?
The correct answer is because it's always been done that way. Before the new system, lawyer regulation system was created, and even in the new lawyer regulation system, and in practice before 2000, the Board of Attorneys' Professional Responsibility would perform character and fitness investigations on behalf of the board or at the request of the Board of Bar Examiners. And that provision still exists in the rules at the end of Chapter 22. We have not done that during the tenure of OLR, and we have not been asked to do that. The administrative reinstatement provisions from which this petition was drafted relate to the administrative suspensions for dues or for CLE, and those particular rules provide that copies of the petitions for those who have been suspended more than 3 years be filed both with BBE and OLR, and then those two provisions assign OLR the responsibility to do that same eligibility analysis that we're talking about in this rule. So that's why we do it, is because we always have.
Yeah. I just don't know if it makes sense from a managerial point of view. What do you think?
I think that there is a natural, logical connection with the Board of Bar Examiners to handle matters that relate to this, because it's not a disciplinary matter. It's merely an admissions or an eligibility to practice matter in its real context. The advantage for OLR would be that we have regular communications and contacts with disciplinary agencies in other states, and access to information through the ABA database of discipline, such that we can get some information a little bit more readily. And so that would just be one advantage for OLR to do it.
We've had cases for admissions from BBE, you know, way back. If someone has some issues that might not be dealing with discipline from other states, but we're really the subject of great concern for the Board of Bar Examiners as just whether or not the person met character and fitness. A lot of parking tickets was one of them.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think there were issues about maybe what was going on in tests, and truthfulness. How is your office geared up to make checks? Do you check with the schools in your character and fitness? Do you check on the same kind of things that BBE routinely does in their character and fitness?
We would not normally contact the law school. We would check some of the same things that BBE checks. I mean, we would check to see if there are records of convictions or arrests. We would get character references from individuals in each of these cases, and we would have contact with any licensing agencies to see if there were any and there was any private discipline or unreported public discipline, perhaps. So we would be aware of some of the same information, but we would not treat it as an initial application. We would presume that when the person was initially admitted to practice, that there was a satisfactory character and fitness check at that time. So we would not go back beyond that, just as a normal course. It would only be if some issue arose for some reason where that became relevant. It's possible a lawyer might not have been admitted very long, suspended, and then we may have learned something that we didn't know before in doing our normal background check. But
now, from a very selfish point of view, what's the court impact on this? I can envision a number of lawyers graduating from Wisconsin law schools, immediately taking, or soon thereafter, taking inactive status, and during a good part of their career working in Arizona and Texas and California and Vermont and any other state that you want to select. But then they want and work and are in firms and actively engaged, but they decide to come back to Wisconsin. And under this proposal, as I understand it now, if it's more than 10 years that they've been on inactive status, this comes to the court. What's the court impact on this? How many do you intend of these people who've been busily practicing in California and now return to Wisconsin because their mother wants them to come home? Are we going to have to be approving, and you are going to have to investigating for character and fitness?
The difference here is simply the number of requests for transfer to active status for lawyers who, while inactive in Wisconsin more than 10 years, have been actively practicing in another jurisdiction compared to those who may not have been actively practicing in any jurisdiction during that 10-year period. I think the number of those cases is going to be less than 10 a year. And I think that there's not a significant impact. I think the court then is going to take action when it receives the memorandum from BBE and OLR, and then review that and make a decision. So there will be a hand few more of these for the court to review every year. But I think it will be a small percentage of the requests for transfer to inactive status. And I don't think it'll be more than 10 a year. I think it'll be less than that.
So if somebody came to you and said, probably not going to practice law in Wisconsin, maybe I'll never come back, but it'll be a long time. What should I do? Should I resign, or should I be inactive, inactive status? So the differences would be, one, do I need approval from anybody, or do I just resign, assuming I'm in good standing, no problems?
Right.
And take inactive status at the bar.
Right. If the court adopts these two proposals, right. I think my advice to a lawyer in that situation would probably relate to how much money it's going to cost both during the time you're inactive and what it will cost to get back in. So we know it's going to cost $400 to get back in. Under both conditions.
Okay. And so get back in is $400.
Right. And if it's the inactive dues is half the normal dues, so that's $400 roughly in 2 years, although please
don't. That's why you're inactive. You have to pay dues. According to the state bar, it's $195.
So if you're going to be inactive more than 2 years, you should resign. And if you're going to be inactive less than 2 years, you should go inactive.
Okay, inactive for less than 2 years.
Right, if you anticipate less than 2 years, it makes sense financially, to a very small degree, to go inactive. If you're going to be inactive more than that, then it makes financial sense to maybe a larger degree to resign. Because the process for obtaining your authority to practice again is essentially the same process.
But if I resign and I want back in, the bar says, that the petition must be accompanied by a $200 check payable to the BBE. And the board has to recommend that I come back in. And I'll have to fulfill my continuing legal education requirements.
Right.
and no other bar dues then, if I have resigned?
I'm not sure that I know the answer to the bar dues question.
Okay, but I'm going to ask the bar that. But if I'm inactive, I'm going to have these continuations, but I'm still going to have to take CLE.
Right. And depending on the answer to the bar dues question, whether it's a two-year decision point or a later decision
right.
point could be affected.
Because I may have to take 30 credit hours or 60 credit hours.
Yes. Right.
Okay. The state bar submitted an explanation of that, but and we asked and they answered, it's under tab 5 of the court, but they answered, and as we asked if inactive and emeritus, and I wanted a, I'm asking for a third column in effect on resignation, and,
okay.
and you responded, it would be economical for me to just resign for 2 years.
I think for many lawyers, it will be economical for them to resign, yes.
You know, what happens when you have a lawyer who's worked hard in Shawnee, Wisconsin, and had his career and had his kids, and now at age, let's say 65, or pick an age, 60, decides he wants to move to Arizona and be inactive. But his lifeblood, his community, his identity is his profession as a lawyer and a member of the State Bar of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So now you're saying, better off to cut all those ties, even though that's, you know, maybe on those license plates he has Wisconsin attorney, you know.
Whistler.
That's right, Whistler. You're saying, oh, no, better resign. And what if he says, well, you know, I'd like to pay inactive dues, because they're only half, and become emeritus. This is who I am. This is my legacy. And now the rule apparently is that in order to become emeritus, you have to go from inactive, and then you have to become active, which means you have to take 60 CLE credits, only then to become emeritus is what you always wanted to be. This makes no sense to me.
If you're eligible under the new rules for emeritus.
You know, this makes no sense to me. I mean, who are our constituents? You know, it's the public, but also here, it's
right.
the bar, members of the bar. Why are we doing this to them?
That is a question I think is a good question. It is not addressed by this petition that I think should be addressed by another petition. I'd be happy to assist the court.
It's not addressed by this petition, you say, because this petition doesn't deal with emeritus. And we have an emeritus status, and we have a petition, which we're going to discuss later today, that changes classification, and as I remember it, puts two separate categories of emeritus.
Yes, and I think that's an appropriate mechanism to address that concern, but I share your concern.
It won't matter here, you're saying, because you're not dealing with emeritus, you're dealing with either inactive or resigned.
Yes, that's right. Thank you, Chief.
If someone is practicing actively in another state but is inactive in Wisconsin, do they have the same obligations to report any convictions or misconduct in the other state?
Yes, they do, Justice, yes.
Okay, and if they didn't realize that or if they didn't do it, and you're investigating them when they apply for active status, do you prosecute them?
Yes, I mean, yeah, assuming the conviction, and there would be a count for the conviction, 8.4B, there would be a count for failing to comply with 21.15 sub 5, and you've seen these on regular occasion. In the course of a reinstatement or a request to transfer to active status, we will typically allow the court, recommend the court process that and grant the transfer and then open another matter in that circumstance. And then have a separate grievance process, investigation, and perhaps a complaint filed with the court.
They wouldn't have any obligation to report if they resign.
That's right. That's right, Justice. That's exactly right. That's the difference in the time period to require a fitness review eligibility review after any period of resignation. It could be manipulated.
Well, if they resigned and they want back in, they'd have to make an application for admission.
They do not, Your Honor, under this proposal, because this is not treated as an admission process. It's treated as an administrative reinstatement process under this petition.
Okay.
It's titled a readmission, but it is not an admission like you might think of it. One of the ways
maybe you should entitle it differently, so I don't.
I think readmission is the correct title as it's presented in the petition, but I think I understood your question to relate to an initial admission process. A lawyer does not have to go under Chapter 40 to get readmitted.
But he has to do something, right?
Right.
And so are you in 7 and 8? Is that where this is covered?
It would be in 1003 sub 7A and 7B.
That's what I'm saying.
That's where you cover.
That's where they just covered. That's right.
Well, before you accept his resignation or her resignation, you're going to ask whether or not there are any pending grievances, investigations, or proceedings. And if they reveal they've got a problem, you may not accept the resignation.
If we are aware of a problem, we will advise the court. And that has been our practice. Our practice is to review our records at the time we receive the notice of the resignation, to check our database to see if we have any information. We are not checking other state databases at that time.
And then they file a petition for readmission to the court, yep, they pay $200, and within 90 days, the BBE determines eligibility, and then within 90 days, the director determines eligibility. So that's when you would find out that they've had a felony that they didn't report.
That would be correct, Chief Justice.
And then you're going to advise us to let them in or not let them in?
We will advise you one way or the other, depending upon the particulars of the matter. And a good example is the Polk matter that I cited in my August 15th memo, where we advised against it. And typically, we'll find that it may be a minor matter, or it doesn't affect their fitness overall, but it is a disciplinary violation, and we'll open a separate matter.
Okay, so we admit them, and then you will open a matter
correct.
Against them. That's what
correct,
I thought
Chief
you
Justice.
Said. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any other questions?
State Bar of Wisconsin supports this.
They did. They are co-petitioners, Justice. They are. They are co-petitioners, Justice. They support this petition.
Okay. Why?
That question you have to address to them. I was concerned about the fact that they may lose some dues money, and I thought they might be concerned about that, but the Bar Board of Governors did not vote in accordance with that concern. I think they saw it as an appropriate means to handle the membership categories, but I'm not the person to really address your question.
There are Board of Administrative Oversight, the State Bar of Wisconsin, OLR, and BBE are joint petitioners.
That's correct, Chief Justice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other comments?
Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Keith, Celine, for introducing this. And this has been an issue that's sort of come to the court in a variety of different ways, and the court had issues about what's the difference, how much does it cost, what are the CLE consequences. So this is very helpful. And through discussions with your office and with the State Bar, I think we have done better in readmitting people, and whether it's from inactive to active or on resignation, so that when they get notice from us, they know how much CLE is due and when, and how much the state bar dues are. because that's not an easy calculation. So we appreciate that.
You're very welcome, Chief Justice, Justices.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a no appearances noted on 1303 in the matter of the petition to amend 1003-3 and 1003-7. In light of the questions and comments, does anyone wish to appear and assist the court in this discussion?
May it please the court.
We have a volunteer.
May it please the court. My name is George Brown. I'm the executive director of the State Bar of Wisconsin. I'll be happy to answer any questions related to the petition as it affects the State Bar and its activities.
Anything that affects the classification of membership in your other petition is that something that we have to worry about here or take it up then?
Well, the issue that was raised, I think, by Justice Bradley is one of those unintended consequences of a previous action. It was raised, if you remember, many years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, the issue was raised by the administrative law judges as to whether they would be classified as judicial or non-judicial. And as a result of the discussion that came out of that, one of the recommendations, one of the requests by then BBE Director Casa Bucky, he raised the issue of individuals, much like it was addressed here, who are practicing out of state, have been inactive members of the state bar, retire from, say, 30 years of practice in California, come back to Wisconsin, take emeritus status, and they go instantly from inactive to active. We don't know if they've had any CLE credits, those sorts of things. And so the current rule was put in place to say that, essentially, that if you go from inactive to active, you have to have certain requirements met, and when you go to emeritus, since that is essentially, although it's not stated clearly in the rules, it's essentially a subcategory of active. You then have to take the credits, but the unintended consequence was anybody who is active in Wisconsin, who goes inactive at 65 because they've retired from the practice, then wish to go to emeritus at age 70. Have to go through the same process as if they'd practiced in California for 30 years. That is what needs to be cleared up, I think. And we've been handling it informally, quite frankly, between the current director of BBE and myself as to, you know, just kind of letting that little rule slide till we get it cleaned up.
When will it be officially cleaned up?
Well, since it happens very rarely, quite honestly, Director Rothstein and I have, it's on our list to do.
Okay, but doesn't affect this?
No.
Does it affect your emeritus? This petition, that's 09.
This proposal does not really affect our emeritus.
So they can be handled separately, but
right.
When we get to emeritus, we might want to look back.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Are there any questions of?
Just for background information, the vast majority of inactive members in the State Bar of Wisconsin are non-resident lawyers. There we have about 25,000 members. About 8,000 of those individuals are non-resident lawyers. They live and work outside of Wisconsin, and about 65 or so percent of those people are inactive. So it's a huge category of our inactive membership. They do not resign, in fact. They stay inactive because I think that they either wish to come back or they just want the ties to the state.
You may not be the person to answer this question, so you'll be quick to tell me that. But I had, if it's correct, I questioned Mr. Saleen about if in a reciprocity there is a character and fitness assessment. Do you happen to know that answer?
I can take a guess, and my guess is yes, okay. But I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you for your cooperation with us, the State Bar's cooperation with us on these reinstatements and readmissions and resignations. Because your rules about how much to pay are
depend much on the circumstances of the time, et cetera, and that your calculations that you give us that we can put in our orders seem to be working.
I think it's cleaned up, it's streamlined the process to the benefit of the members as well as the agencies, so.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to appear in relation to 13-03? If not, the hearing on 13-03 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rules 10.033 and 7, those are subsections relating to inactive members requesting active status and readmission after resignation from the bar, is closed. The court's